All right. Well, first we'd like to tell you a little bit about Japan. Japan is a well-fed nation that's often overlooked when people think about mission work. But it has a population of 127 million people, and less than 1% of them are Christians, which makes it, I've heard different accounts, it's at the very least it's one of the largest unreached people groups in the entire world, if not the largest. And despite the fact that they do live fairly comfortable lives, they're still subject to the hazards of a people without the gospel. They have a very high-pressure society, and they have the largest suicide rate in the industrial world, three times higher than the U.S., and Japan is also one of the number one destinations for human trafficking victims worldwide. So our intention as we go to Japan is to use some of the same methods of evangelism that we have read about in our study of the book of Acts. Starting with what the first principle is engaging with the Japanese culture. As we're here, as we prepare, we continue to study Japanese culture and language and history in order to find different opportunities, different methods of presenting the gospel in a way that is relevant to the lives of the Japanese people. The church plant that we're joining keeps a very keen eye on Japanese culture and seeks to find new ways to introduce them to Jesus. I mentioned to a few of you the most popular sort of method is to offer community classes, usually English conversation, that people like to come to as a way of introducing them to the church. But as I mentioned, they do keep an eye on culture, and right now guitar is becoming really popular in Japan, and I play guitar, and so I'll probably be teaching guitar as well when we go there.
We'll also be planting new church bodies. The church plant that we're joining is called Nishin Christian Church. It has 80-plus members and 100 people attending Sunday morning, which is like a mega church in Japan. Normally, their churches are pretty small. In the next few years, they have plans for new church plants and in other parts of Nagoya near colleges and other places where young people gather. Their main goal is to reach the young people of Japan who will become the future leaders of Japan.
And the third principle we see from Acts is forging long-term mission relationships. We aren't going on this mission alone. We'll be relying on financial pledges and also on prayers of friends back home and connections with PCA churches like yours. I personally became interested in Japan when I was in high school. I took a few martial arts as I was growing up, but especially when I learned in history class about samurai culture and different things about that, I thought it was pretty cool. Throughout college, I would learn things about it now and then. It never became kind of an emphasis of official study for me, but I would buy a book here and there, and I read the Shogun, the novel called Shogun, which some people may have read here. It's very popular. And at one point, I even took kendo, which is Japanese fencing that involves bamboo swords and a lot of ice afterward. It's actually pretty painful. And one day, I finally learned about what I told you, that less than 1% of the Japanese people are Christians. And for weeks, I couldn't get that fact out of my head. It just brought me down. Every time I was trying to focus on one thing, it would just come back into my brain that was going on. Eventually, I asked God if he was trying to tell me something. I looked at all their impressive cultural achievements. They're very dedicated. They have kind of a collective harmony. They're great with hospitality. They care for the elderly. And yet it seemed that they lacked the most important relationship in life, a relationship with Christ. So during my last year of college, I came to understand that God had put this people on my heart for a reason, that he wanted me to become a missionary to the Japanese.
Justin was the one who introduced me to Japanese culture and people. When we were dating, it was just really clear to me that he was called to Japan. It was a lot of what he talked about and just is always on his mind. Then he spent a year in Japan, and during my Christmas break, I was a high school math teacher, I went to go see him, and I met the people, and I experienced the culture, and I loved it. After he got back, we got married, and then I realized that I also was going to Japan. And then when we started talking about it more seriously, I realized that I wanted a specific call for me. You know, I knew my husband was called to Japan, and Like, he had a very specific call in his life, but I wanted something personally for me. And I prayed about it a lot, and God showed me that I have a real heart for missionary kids. Growing up, like, I had a lot of friends who were missionary kids in, like, Portugal and Germany and Spain, all over. I've seen what they go through, and I want to help them through all their different struggles. And also, after having two little ones, I'm really excited to spend time with Japanese mothers and, you know, just help them through their struggles, too, because when you're a mom, cultural differences don't seem to matter as much. There's a lot of things you have in common just, you know, with having kids.
And I'd like to share with you a few stories, just a little bit more background. I went to Japan with an organization which at the time was had a different name. Now it's called MB Missions, which was a Mennonite Brethren group. We both went to Fresno Pacific University, which has strong ties to the Mennonite Church, and they were the ones that said yes, so I went with them. And I'd like to share with you a few stories from that year that I spent in Japan back in, it was from August of 2005 to August of 2006. Near Christmas time, we gathered about 75 elementary age children into the small church and proceeded to make crafts, sing songs, play games, and generally all have a great time. Christmas in Japan is really something to see. It has all of the glitz and tinsel of Christmas in the States, but it has none of the nativity. It doesn't have any baby Jesus to proclaim. And yet here we were, me and my fellow teachers of a church-affiliated English school, with 75 young children and the opportunity to tell them the true reason for Christmas celebration. My coworker, the school's owner, a woman named Nozomi, she handed me a Santa suit. We had not discussed this ahead of time. But apparently she had bought it earlier in the week and just forgot to tell me about it, and she insisted that I put it on and play Santa. So for the day, I was Santa Claus. And as I stepped onto the stage, as we gathered the kids together, the whole church was just flooded with deafening laughter of small children. It was obviously Justin Sensei in the Santa suit. And obviously the Santa suit was meant for a shorter and much slimmer individual. But nonetheless, we soldiered on. I had already been a little bit worried that the children would have trouble listening to the Christmas story. And especially now that I was in a ridiculous outfit, I thought, this is doomed. I'm going to get drowned out by talking and giggling. But I took my seat by the microphone, and Nozomi was prepared to translate my words, and she had these big story picture cards. And I began by asking the students, how many of you know who I am? And they all yelled, Santa Claus. They do know Santa Claus in Japan. And I asked, what do I do at Christmas time? And they said, you bring us presents. Very exciting. Then I asked, does anybody know why I give gifts at Christmas? And the whole building was filled with silence. No one seemed to know. So I answered, I give gifts at Christmas time to remind people about the best present that was ever given. And so I told the story of Christmas kind of using those terms, that Christ was the gift that's meant to reunite mankind with our loving Creator. And what I thought would be just a rowdy kind of time where I'd be trying to shout over the children became a really blessed memory. The children just stared at the picture cards. They were just awed by this story. 75 Japanese children, just completely in awe. I had gotten to know each and every one of these kids from my English class, and polite listening was not really in their skill set. So for me, it was pretty clear that the Holy Spirit had been at work in their hearts and was telling them to listen, telling them that what was being said was important. And for all of its seeming stubbornness to accept the gospel, that occasion still remains in my mind to be the best evidence I found that there's the Japanese are a spiritually hungry people who are longing for a God who is more than just a statue, more than just a story. They long for a God who draws near to them, a God like Jesus. At a different church, that was with an English school I was working with, there were also two churches that I was just kind of teaching out of. And at one of them, I had this incident occur. The English lesson had finally ended, and I eagerly began what we call chapel time. I spent most of the previous week praying for this day. It was the day I was finally going to present the gospel to my advanced English conversation class in Komaki. I'd spent months laying the groundwork, every week going over a different, very basic Christian teaching. 95% of the Japanese have never heard the gospel, so you can't just jump in with sin, and they need to understand what sin means. Partly because the Japanese word for sin also means crime. So we want to make sure that we're not telling them they can go out and commit crimes when they come to Jesus. So I'd spent all these months laying this foundation, and all but one of the students, I knew one of the students in the class was a Christian, but the rest I was pretty sure had probably never heard the gospel at all. So I learned all the necessary kanji, which is the pictogram language that they have. I learned all the kanji I needed to help the story seem a little bit less foreign and less Western, a little more native, which is important to the Japanese. And so I began to draw an illustration, which I call you've probably seen it, it's the like the cliffs with God and man, and the cross becomes a bridge between the two. The cross-bridge diagram. It seemed to work pretty well with other people I'd shared it with. And I got all the way to the end of the story when one student named Toru asked a question. He said, "Why would God do all of this to be with us?" And I explained, "Because God loves us." And I said, "We Christians even go as far as to say that God is love." And I illustrated, writing more kanji on the board, the kanji for love. And just as I was about to close in prayer, a man named Dr. Umeda spoke up. "Every religion says that," he said, and he waved his hand derisively at the whiteboard. The whole room was just filled with silence. You could have heard a pin drop onto the carpet. Teachers in Japan have kind of an elevated position. They greatly respect educators, and so to contradict one is a bit of a breach of their usual politeness, but this is kind of the catch when you're an American or any foreigner really in Japan. If you're not Japanese, you get a pass. I would get a pass whenever I'd mispronounce a word or if I do something that they usually consider rude. They don't expect us to know any of their rules. They don't expect us to follow them. They don't even think about it. But that has a flip side, that they also feel a little freer to express themselves to us and to say what they're really thinking, which, believe it or not, is a blessing, especially in this situation. As I heard him contradict my story this way, my brain really just kind of shut down and panicked. I was not expecting anyone to openly challenge what I was telling them. This was not something I'd prepared for at all. So I quietly prayed for a solid second. I prayed for the Holy Spirit to give me some words to respond. I felt I can't just say, "Well, let's close in prayer," after this man's just said this. So I opened my mouth and I spoke what I felt I'd been given. I said, "Umeda-san, you are right." And the other students looked kind of surprised that I said this, particularly the Christian student in the room, that I would just say, "You're right." I said, "You're right that every religion says this. But we believe that God did more than just say that he loves us. He put his love into action and showed us his love when he sent his son to die for us so that we could be with him." They were all leaned forward at this point, and many of them were probably thinking, many of them probably had been thinking the same thing that Dr. Umeda had said aloud. And I continued and decided to bring Connie into the equation. And I said, if I tell my girlfriend, Connie, that I love her, she'll probably feel pretty happy. But if I never bother to call her or talk to her about important things, if I never make time for us to be together, she'll know that my love is just words. My words are words are just wind. It's through action that love is shown, and it's through Jesus' actions and dying on the cross for us that God's love was revealed to us. And the students sat back and appeared to be kind of thinking over what had been said. And I knew that if it wasn't for Dr. Umeda's opposition, I probably never would have had a chance to express the gospel quite that clearly. And hearing no other objections, I closed the lesson in prayer.
Michio-san was a friend that I made when I visited Japan, and she was actually in that class Justin was just talking about. She is an incredible, brilliant engineer, and me being a math teacher, we kind of had a little connection there. She has a world map in her bathroom that has been altered so the southern hemisphere is on top, and it really made me think, because, you know, in space, like, there really is no north and south. So she's really unique. She gave up a lot to follow Christ. She was the only one in her family that is a Christian. And after she became a Christian, her family didn't talk to her that much and didn't invite her to holidays. And she's also completely dedicated to Jesus and the church. She always shows up early to church. She's involved in everything they do. And just when I think about her, I think of Matthew 19:29. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or lands for my name's sake will receive a hundredfold and will inherit eternal life. Oh, and we have a couple stories from the church that we're joining, the Nishin Christ Church, of what they're doing. And so this is a story from them. Recently, a young man from a Christian family became engaged to a young woman whose family belonged to one of the country's many Buddhist cults. As they were making wedding preparations, he felt God tugging on his heart and realized that he wanted to return to his Christian faith, and he wanted his family to follow Christ as well. So he and his fiance began attending Nishin Christian Church, and she began meeting with our team leader, Amy Newsom, asking questions about the Bible and learning about Christianity. And a few days before their wedding, she accepted Christ, and since then, they become active members in their church.
This coming Easter, Nishin Christian Church is preparing to baptize 5 adults, including Mrs. N. Mrs. N's husband came to faith a few years ago, learning Christianity from a Jesus storybook Bible and some guidance from one of our team members. After he became a Christian, he would teach his wife about Christianity using that same storybook Bible, and now she has decided to follow Jesus as well, making another Christian family in Japan.
We hope you have a better understanding of the big picture of Japan. The work can be daunting and seems impossible, but we are blessed to serve a God whom nothing is impossible, who takes conventional wisdom and turns it upside down, who has abounding love and compassion for all people, who has called us to take the light he has placed within us into all the dark corners of the earth.
And if you'd like more information about some of the specifics of our ministry, we have our kiosk set up out there in that room. I don't know what to call it. but that one. And so you can read more about it there. If any of you feel moved to join our financial support team, please do. We are still raising support to go to Japan for this, and things are moving along pretty nicely, I think. And, please join us. If you feel God calling you to do that, and I understand it now, we'll do a little Q&A. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that then. Any questions?
Tell us about the city of Nagoya.
Yeah.
Well, the city of Nagoya is the third largest city in Japan, which is why you haven't heard of it, because it's only number 3. and it has 2 million people living there. It is in a very traditional part of Japan. Tokyo is a little more kind of progressive, and Osaka too, because they get so many foreign business people there, and they have to have kind of a more, have a different outlook. But Nagoya doesn't get as much attention, and so it's a little more, even though it is a city of 2 million, it is very metropolitan. It's still fairly steeped in Japanese tradition. I think the biggest church that's there is a sect of Shinto, which is called Tenrikyo, which none of it I really fully understand. Shinto is the native Japanese religion that worships nature and heroes and ancestors. Nagoya does have quite a few. It is where I lived when I was there 2 years ago, and they're actually sending us back to the same district where I lived, which I thought was kind of providence, really. I expected we'd be just, wherever they wanted us, and it turned out they wanted us. I actually met who Connie mentioned, Amy Newsom. I met her while I was there at a Bible study. So, it is. Nagoya is kind of up and coming. When I was there, it was the site of the 2005 World Expo, which was sort of a big deal at the time. They have one of the world's only magnetic levitation trains, which sounds a lot cooler than it actually looks. It doesn't look any different than a normal train, really. You just don't see the wheels because it floats like probably that high off of the track, so not at all like the movies, but still pretty cool, I guess.
The movie, I'm sure you've seen it, The Last Samurai.
Yeah.
Can you give me your perspective of the issues in that movie, being a Christian, and how that movie has affected people in Japan?
Yeah, well, Ken Watanabe, first of all, is bigger than Tom Cruise in Japan. He is like the number one movie star. That's the guy who plays the main samurai. He's a superstar in Japan. Very cool guy, so to speak. The Last Samurai is interesting because it was made by Americans, as I understand it anyway. It wasn't. They did consult, obviously, with Eastern, obviously, history. But it's interesting, if you own the DVD to The Last Samurai, I highly recommend watching some of the, I don't remember what it was called, but a friend of mine owns it, and we watched one of the extra features, and it was like the making of or something like that, and they actually had a historian come and basically tell them, the filmmakers, that they'd gotten their bad guys and good guys mixed up. The samurai, as noble and brave as they were, represented 4% of the population in Japan at the time, and they more or less ruled with an iron fist over the other 96%. This was medieval feudalism we're talking about. So, you know, what ended up happening when the country modernized is women gained the right to vote. People in general gained the right to vote. I mean, it was a really big shift. It was a big shift in a short amount of time. The period in history is called the Meiji Restoration, and is definitely one of the more interesting periods to study. But any time there's change in history, you're going to have people who object to it, and on occasion are going to take up arms against it. Also, though, is a very I like history way too much, which is why I can't stop talking about this. another brief side note, the area in Japan where they came from, where the samurai were set up who were rebelling, is called Satsuma, and it's actually historically pretty famous for being like, if you're a rebel in Japan, you go to Satsuma. it's kind of farther. It was one of the farthest places from the capital, so if there was a rebellion, it was usually going to start there anyway. So a little less connected. And of course, the American character in that movie is completely fictional and made up. So, still an interesting movie for getting to know samurai culture, though. They did follow sort of the principles of Bushido pretty closely with the samurai themselves, with the constant training and things like that. And if you check out our blog, which is on our business cards, then I have a series that's running on the blog called Bushido by Numbers, based on the book Bushido, all about samurai ethics and how those have informed Japanese culture. It was actually written by a Christian Japanese man back in 1900, who was famous for other reasons, but anyway.
You mentioned about a ministry to university students, and I'm wondering if those universities over there, if they have as many international groups as we have in our universities here. In other words, we can be ministering to a diverse group of people from different countries as well as the Japanese, or just pretty much Japanese?
The Japanese keep their universities pretty locked down from foreign influence, which makes them sound terrible. But that's the best way I can describe them. There are study abroad programs. Like, there are Americans who go over there. I actually read a book about the Japanese mafia a while back that was written by a guy who went to Tokyo University and was one of the only foreigners ever to gain Japanese companies. This is going to probably blow everyone's minds. But Japanese companies actually offer a certain number of people lifetime employment at their firm, depending on the different companies. And so this particular individual had gotten offered lifetime employment at one of the newspapers. And, of course, writing stories is how he got mixed up with the mob and almost killed. And it's an interesting book. The universities in Japan, they don't have near the international focus that a lot of American universities do. Most likely we'd be ministering just to Japanese students. If we run into anyone who speaks Spanish, though, we will have an advantage. So.
Was Nagoya affected by the earthquake?
The tsunami.
And were you there at the time?
No. I was there in 2005-2006. That occurred in 10 or 11. Yeah, just pretty recently. Nagoya was not directly affected by any radiation or the tsunami itself. It's actually it's on the southern, it's like right in the middle of the southern coast, kind of in between Tokyo and Osaka on the sides. And it was not directly affected. Obviously, people were affected there by it. However, the exciting thing I gotta phrase this right so it doesn't sound like I'm celebrating over some disaster, but the exciting thing in the aftermath of the disaster, I guess we could say, is that the churches in Japan have really stepped up. And pretty much in any community in Japan right after the tsunami hit, if you wanted to take canned food or blankets or anything to help the survivors, you would go to a church to drop it off, which is an improvement because previous to that, it was basically the Japanese mafia who would open up their offices to refugees and would try to gain some goodwill. But that's not the focus of this lecture. So I'm kind of fascinated with the organized crime. So anyway, take it that way you will.
How would you connect Japanese culture to the
Dalai Lama? What?
You know, that's...
I actually did a post on our blog, I think back in November, that was about one of the warlords in Japan from long ago, one of the great unifiers, actually, who early in his life, his brother betrayed him, and he murdered his brother, and so I jokingly said, like, you did it to me, Yuki, you did it to me. It was just Godfather reference, so. Which I'm sure, like, three people probably got of all the... Connie's mom reads our blog all the time, and she probably had no idea what I was talking about. Not really her kind of movies. Other questions? Oh.
I've read that within Japanese culture, because the population is so dense, they do a lot of inward cutting off of, so that they can take time just to be them by themselves, even though they're among a bunch of people. Did you see any of that? And
you're talking about, like, solitude? That's a great question. One of the nice things about Nagoya that I forgot to mention, actually, is that it's, for a city of 2 million people, it's a little more rural. It's, in some ways, it's kind of just like a bigger Fresno, I guess, if you've been to Fresno. Maybe bigger Bakersfield. I don't know Bakersfield well enough to say. But it does, there was actually, to get to the English school I mentioned earlier, I had to walk through a rice paddy. I didn't have to, but I usually did because it was fun to walk through. Especially because we're both from a town called Dainuba, which is very agrarian, and so that was kind of one of my little mini vacations, was walking through the rice paddies on the way to made me feel a little bit like I was at home, that there was food being grown nearby. There are a few places you can find. That being said, about Nagoya, there are some places in Nagoya you can go where there generally won't be a lot of other people around, if at all. If you don't mind bugs, sometimes. I tried to make a video early on where I went to a mountain that was nearby, and it was in the middle of, it was toward the end of summer, which is cicada season, and Japanese cicadas probably broadcast at 120 decibels or louder. They're just really loud buzzing noise constantly all around you all the time. How it affected me, I got really used to being around people. One of the funny ways it sort of affected me, since it was typically Japanese people I was all around, was I would get super excited whenever I would see another foreigner like myself, or a black person, or, you know, someone who was not Asian. I would get really excited and want to engage them, and sometimes they wouldn't speak English, and, you know, that would be a lot of fun because I don't speak German or whatever, you know. And the way it affects the gospel, and this is probably becoming true of American culture too. Jesus used a lot of, like, farming metaphors and things like that. And while we can kind of cognitively understand what he's talking about, like, maybe one person in this room statistically actually farms their own land. Actually, are there any farmers in the room? I should ask first. This is Bakersfield. My cousins work here and they farm. Oh, okay. Well, there's a garden at least. The society in general is kind of changing in that direction too, urbanizing a lot. It does mean it has affected Japanese culture. I mentioned their collective harmony. That's kind of the main thing with Japanese culture, is you don't want to disturb other people's harmony. So Japanese people generally will not fight with one another openly. They won't openly argue. When a conflict gets to the point where they're going to openly argue, it's going to be bad. Things are probably going to get thrown. It's because they bottled up, you know, whatever it is that's bothering them for so long. So, it's one of my students called it the small island effect, that, you know, when you live on a small island, you want to be getting along with your neighbors. You don't want a lot of fighting, a lot of unpleasantness. But being humans, eventually it does happen. And so I did minor in conflict management in college, and our team leaders mentioned that would probably come in handy in mediating conflicts within church people, because it's tricky in Japan, and this is something I have mentioned to other audiences. When I found something in Japan that would bother me, but it would only bother me as an American and not really as like a Christian, I'd have to remind myself I'm here to spread the gospel. I'm not here to import American culture. So yeah, some of the things as a church they have to figure out kind of, you know, on their own.
What would be an example of
like? Yeah, that's a good question. It's not as clear as it used to be, and this was one of the post-World War II changes, but there used to be basically two kinds of, I mentioned it, Shinto, the Japanese national religion. There was the religious aspect of Shinto, where there were priests and different things, and you throw money into a box, and the god is, there's 8 million gods in Shinto, just so you know, is the saying. It really means infinite. But there was also the state Shinto, which still is kind of around, and then that'll be like they'll build a shrine to like a famous Japanese hero, or not necessarily a warrior. Sometimes it'll be somebody who, you know, founded a labor union or something like that, somebody who did some really positive change in society. And some of the Japanese Christians, they still want to go and visit those shrines because they want their children to admire Japanese heroes, obviously. And so it gets tricky with figuring out, like, okay, can they make a donation? Is that a religious act? Obviously, they can't pray to the idol. That is pretty much the line. So yeah, it's kind of a fine line in Japan between worshiping a hero as a religious act and worshiping a hero because it's someone you admire and maybe aspire to make a positive change the way they did. So that would probably be an example.
I've read where, you know, a country is endowed with certain resources, you know, minerals or agricultural land, and the Japanese are kind of stripped of that. So I've read where they see their natural resources or people. In other words, these guys will try and put a computer in an oscillator to save energy to keep from having to buy and rely on others. And they will, instead of like the Yosemite National Park, they'll have an individual that's a great weaver that comes to watch it. Is that
not the other? There is still a very high respect for people who master a craft. The Japanese, and this is, there are some things about Japanese culture I wish I could import into American culture, especially since we're right now drawing a small stipend from what we've raised so far in support so that I can do support raising full time right now. But before that, I was a substitute teacher, and so obviously I would have liked to bring in like respect for teachers and things like that. But one thing I really liked about Japanese culture is they consider themselves lifelong learners, in a very real sense. And that's part of why community classes is so successful, because people will say, well, you know, I don't know English. I never really wanted to learn, but maybe I should. And they'll, you know, come to the class and if they have the time or whatever. And so if somebody has taken the time to really, as you mentioned, master weaving or any of the traditional arts especially, yeah, people will come and watch them. They'll pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for their work sometimes. But this is somebody who has spent, you know, tens of thousands of hours like practicing this and really mastering it in a way that they haven't seen before. Not like just a basket, but I mean, you know, probably something larger, but it'll have artistic value of some kind. It won't just be like, wow, they wove it, they did it in and out so well. Like, now it's, you know, it has some pattern or someone's face or, you know, some other aspect. Yeah, good question.
You mentioned all these, and Shinto, all these millions of gods. Mm-hmm. I've also heard Buddhism defined as being atheistic, so how do you, I mean, is it theistic or atheistic?
Buddhism basically, I guess paraphrase Forrest Gump, Buddhism is as Buddhism does. it's really, Buddhism has always been more of a philosophy than a religion, and its tendency has been to kind of glom on to whatever is already there. So if you went to like Vietnam or something, you'd see people probably still practicing a religion that they practiced 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, just with a few like Buddhist aspects kind of sprinkled on the top of it. It's a good way to think about it. And with the Japanese, as I mentioned, their collective harmony, one of the places this runs smack into Christianity is that they consider religion to mostly be a matter of opinion and a matter of preference. And so they don't see the point in getting all upset because so-and-so doesn't follow my religion. They say, well, you know, let him follow his religion, you follow yours. Don't talk about it, for goodness sake. You know, you'll upset the harmony. And so, yeah, obviously is where Christianity runs into a bit of trouble because we're commanded to. As far as, like, with a lot of Japanese people will consider themselves both Shinto and Buddhist, and this is usually regardless of whether they go to a temple ever. It's just kind of part of their national psyche. I mentioned the series I'm doing in the blog talking about samurai ethics and Bushido, and one of them was self-control, which I was talking to somebody about earlier. And the samurai concept of self-control is that you don't show emotion. And that's partly why the Japanese have that kind of reputation worldwide for being very hard to read and very, you know, closed off, and something terrible will happen and they won't show you openly. It doesn't mean that they aren't feeling emotions. They've just really gotten good at training themselves to never, ever display what's on their mind or what's affecting them very deeply until they're alone. And that comes from the Buddhist idea that this life is a veil of tears, suffering comes from basically wanting the world to be better than it is, because it's not. So get over it is kind of the Buddhist philosophy, and that has extended into, the idea of self-control being not showing emotions. But Buddhism itself, some would argue that in its pure form, it's atheistic and it's a path to enlightenment. But for the most part, it just kind of gloms on, and they just add it into whatever they already have. And obviously Christianity isn't a religion. You can typically just add on to whatever you have and really be faithful to it, so...
They believe in evil spirits. I think I hear it says temples, the way they build them is to ward off evil spirits. Is that true?
I have not heard that. I know that part of that was because of snow, but that may also have been free. I honestly don't know.
And karma, right?
Yes, and that's...
Bad karma requires judgment.
Yes, and that is also why there are not a lot of, like, charitable organizations in Japan, or in a lot of Eastern countries, you will not find a lot of, you know, feeding the poor, soup kitchen type things. Japan's, I think, not as extreme as some of the other countries, because there still is an idea that there is a collectivist sort of idea that we are all in this together. We need to get along with one another. We don't want anyone to starve to death. So you will still find some sort of charities, but not near as many as you'll find in the States per capita, because the idea is if somebody is suffering, they probably deserve it. They probably did something bad, even if it's in previous life. If you know, someone's really serious about being Buddhist, they'll think that way, and so you don't interfere with someone's karma. So.
Well, doesn't that come back and kind of bite your karma if you're not
gonna? You should be compassionate. That's where Buddhism is very, very different than Christianity. Is that it's more concerned with detaching yourself from the world, and detaching yourself from a desire for the world to be at a nice place, or to desire things, I guess, and to think about deeper things in life is sort of, as I understand it, the idea. Did you have a...
Okay. When I was really young, a missionary had come to a church that I was at and talked about what happened after World War II with MacArthur, with the sort of deconstruction of the emperor. And MacArthur, at that time, also made an appeal to churches in the United States to send Bibles in, because Japanese, many of them were thinking, well, we lost because our God was not strong enough. The Christian God obviously is stronger. Mm-hmm. And then when there was a response, the Bibles didn't come. They went toward a materialistic ideal rather than embracing Christianity. And I remember the missionary saying that it was very, very difficult post-World War II, this would have been the 60s, late 50s, and 60s, to even introduce the gospel, because there was that barrier that you hadn't sent any Bibles, so obviously it isn't important. And a lot of the churches over here, they didn't want to send Bibles because of the horrific nature of the war.
And some of what happened during World War II on the Japanese side, some of the atrocities and some of the things that they apologize for every single year. That's, of course, a whole different story as to why that never works. A lot of that comes also from the remnants of feudal culture, where if you were captured in battle, that was like the most shameful possible thing was to be captured alive in battle. You were supposed to give your life in battle to fight for whatever cause or whatever person you were representing. And so they kind of thought, as we all tend to think that our culture, we don't really tend to think of which aspects of our culture are universal until we run into a culture where that's not the commonly accepted thing. And so the Japanese figured that was just what everyone thought, and that was part of why so many horrible, horrible things happened in the POW camps that the Japanese ran. But as a reaction to those horrible things, yeah, a lot of countries didn't really want to help Japan after the war. They didn't really feel, they felt like, well, they did all this evil stuff they did. There was a concerted effort to really rebuild Germany, partly because I think the European powers felt like, well, we didn't give Germany a lot of options after World War One because we were a little, you know, geopolitics is complicated, but to say the least. There were missionaries who did go to Japan right after World War II. There were quite a few, actually. The shift to materialism happened pretty quickly, though, I would say. Whether it would have been preventable by more boots on the ground, so to speak, I don't know. I do know a similar thing happened after World War I in Europe, which is largely the reason why a lot of Europe is not really... it's largely the reason that a lot of Europe is, you know, traditionally Catholic, but, you know, hasn't set foot in a church in probably their entire lives, is because of the horrors of World War I and II. So yeah, some of that is when you encounter things that are that horrible, it's hard to understand how there's a loving God in charge of it all. And in Japan, a bigger part of it is, even though the emperor didn't win, being that there are 8 million gods, the emperor may or may not be the most important one in your life. There's no real chief. There's no Zeus, so to speak, in that's probably the best way to say it, actually. There's no Zeus in the Japanese pantheon. It's a buffet religion, whichever one you want to follow. If you have cancer, then go to the god who's famous for healing people with cancer and drop some coins in the box and pray and, you know, breathe in some incense. You know, maybe there'll be a ceremonial pool you can drink from, all that sort of stuff, very ritualized.
How do they receive Americans over there in general, like as far as missionaries and stuff? Because my husband was in the Marine Corps and stationed in Okinawa in Japan, and he said especially the Japanese men, like, there would be businesses like no GIs.
Yeah. If it's an area that has a military base, and especially I know that Okinawa has had a lot of security problems over the years with dealing. In fact, while I was there, there was a horrible case where this young woman was raped by some GIs, and so obviously not great public relations for us. But in most parts, in Nagoya, I never really felt unwelcome. And in fact, probably the best way to describe an American's reception, I mean, at least my reception in Japan, is I was one morning I was on the subway and I was going to whichever church I was going to that day to teach, and at one of the stops on the way, this large class of children came on. And field trips in Japan are fun because the kids all wear school uniforms and they all wear really bright, like, blue or yellow hats. Like, the whole class will have the same hat on to make it easier for the teachers to see, you know, who's where. It's pretty practical, actually. So they came on the subway, and typically nobody talks on the subway. If you came on with a friend, you might talk kind of in hushed tones. If you're a younger person, you might talk a little louder. But especially if you're a little kid, they just talk, blah, 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 you know, loud as possible. So they came onto the car next to mine, and it's just filled with the noise of them talking. And I had a few more stops to go. So we got to the next stop, and I'm still waiting for the stop after that. And I was reading my book, whatever it was, and between two of the stops, I noticed, I was like, it got really quiet. And I was like, I didn't think the kids got off. So I looked over to see if they were still on, and they were all staring at me through the window of the car as if I were a zoo animal. So I waved at them, and then they just cracked up laughing. It was really funny. So in short, I guess a shorter way would have been to say we're kind of a novelty, I guess, to the Japanese. Not a lot of foreigners go to Japan. When they do, like I mentioned, they are actually really hospitable generally, unless there's a military base nearby and there's been incidents. They generally are pretty happy to receive you. They like to practice their English. A lot of them will take English classes but never have a chance to speak it, and so they'll...
Do they stop you to take pictures with you? Like, no, seriously.
No, yeah. I'm trying to think if that ever happened, because I have heard of that happening.
They did that to Nick because he's blonde, and they don't see a lot of blonde people, and they were like, they want their picture with
him. I don't think I had any pictures taken. Nagoya is not, if I would have been, the southern island Kyushu gets almost no visitors at all. So if you went there, oh yeah. Well, even that actually is kind of surprising. But Hi, sweetie. she's starting to say dad. I don't remember anyone taking their picture with me. I think I went there for vacation. Before that, my parents sent me to kind of, you know, sort of suss it out, and I think that may have happened when I was there that time. It was these young girls celebrating their coming of age day, which is this whole holiday, and that I seem to think that may have happened then. That was so many years ago. I did once have a drunk art dealer come up to me at a subway stop and say Guten Tag, thinking I was German. And I was kind of hoping to end the conversation there because he was very obviously drunk at like 9 in the morning or something. Probably not a good day for him. But it turned out he knew like a few words in English, and he basically just kept repeating them over and over to me the whole journey. Thankfully, I got off at one point. He was a nice enough guy. I tried to speak Japanese to him a little bit, but he was wasted. So what can you do? Yeah.
I've heard they don't have the stigma about drinking over there.
Mask
their emotions, and the people really, what happened at the time of the dogs.
And it's for lack of a better term, this just explains it the best way. They do believe in sort of the Mel Gibson doctrine, if you will, that things you do when you're drunk don't matter, so to speak. Throw that one out there. That they don't count. And in fact, the book I mentioned earlier, written by the reporter who brushed up against the mafia, he told a story of going out drinking with a bunch of his friends at the newspaper. And because Japanese people don't really talk about their religion because they don't want conflict over it, he didn't know that one of his coworkers was actually a fanatical emperor worshiper, nationalist, crazy right winger, so to speak. And so he had no idea this was the case, and so they're out drinking, and the guy gets in a fight with him and starts punching him, and he has no idea what's going on, and he found out later, it's because he does all this stuff. But because he did it when he was drunk, there was no, you know, they both let it go. We were drunk, so that was it. So there's a lot of opportunity in going out and drinking with the boss. If he asks you to go out and drink with him on the weekend, you go. Unless you hope to have no career ever, basically you go. I did have one student who I met on Saturdays, like 2 Saturdays a month, I think, and I never ever talked to him when he wasn't hungover. I have no idea what he's like when he's not hungover, because it was Friday night the night before, and he'd gone out drinking very heavily, and so it's, had to teach English with the lights off, a bit of sensitivity for him. But yeah, alcoholism is a huge problem in Japan, though, and it's, Any other questions?
When you plan to move, if you're on track for your funding.
Mm-hmm. With MTW, the rule is we can't go until we have 100% funding. So it's completely based on when we can get fully funded. Right now we're, as I mentioned, I've gone full time in support raising, doing that every day, 8 hours a day. And I go to Starbucks because otherwise these two would never let me get anything done at home because they're so much fun to play with. We're hoping right now our target is we're shooting for, and there's a training event we have to go to in July before we can also go. There's all these different events, and that's the last one, right, Connie? Yeah, okay. Like, we've been to others. There's a big training event. It's a month long. It's in July. It's in New York. So we have to do that also. So what we're kind of trying to do right now is shoot for August or September of this year. We'll see what the Lord does.
I was reading this book, and I think almost certain they were talking about Japan, that in Japan you don't go to the classroom to learn, you go to the classroom to show what you've learned, meaning they do a lot of emphasis on stuff outside the classroom, like tutoring, or what are they?
School is not really... It's emphasized as being important. It's one of those things that's culturally very important, so the students typically do take it seriously a little more on their own than students here, I would say. But in elementary school, most of elementary school is the kids playing around and, getting, like, learning social sort of values, bullying each other, kid stuff. Bullying is a whole different problem in Japan, but, again, ask me about it later if you really want to know the horrors. Yeah, and I was going to say, we should have Connie come up and answer this, because she got her master's in math education and did a whole...
I did a case study on just comparing our education system with Japan, and I think Germany was the other one. And this was And in ours, it was, you know, the teacher up in front, like, doing direct instruction and stuff like that. In Japan, it was the teacher giving a problem, and the students would, you know, work together to solve the problem, and they would come together in the end and just, you know, say what they've gotten from that problem. And it was very more student-based and stuff like that. One of the things of, like, sometimes we try and do stuff like that here, and one of the reasons why it works so well there is they have more of a, what is that called, like a higher...
Hierarchy?
Education is more important.
Yeah. It's more valued.
It's more valued in their culture than it is in ours.
Yeah.
Especially, like, you know, different parts of our country. And so, like, you know, solving the problem was just, like, you know, very important to them. Hmm. They have more of that type of education.
It would turn into just a goof-off session. Like,
yeah, it wouldn't. Like, they were there to learn.
Yeah, especially when they get into junior high, that's when the hammer comes down. That's when it becomes, you go to junior high every day until, like, I think it's the same as hours we keep, more or less, you know, 8 to 3. But then 3 to 6 or 7 or 8 sometimes is cram school, which is after school school, which is, yeah, where you go to really get everything done. Yeah, we did have, I did have one student who was in high school, and that continues in high school because it's, you know, you do well in junior high. The high schools there are ranked, three-tiered, and that was one of the funny things a pastor told me when I first got there. He said, when you meet the high school students who come to our church, do not ask them where they go to high school, because if they go to the top-ranked high school, they'll just get all puffed up with pride, and if they go to a low-ranked high school, they'll feel ashamed to have to admit that they go to a low-ranked high school. So don't ask them, which is weird, because, you know, here it's very common. Where do you go to school? I'll go here, there. But no, there it's an opportunity for Satan to work, I guess. And usually what I found was the case, and this is the student I'm talking about, if a student goes to a top-ranked high school, they'll let you know. you don't need to ask. They'll bring it up. Every time I talked to this guy for the first month I knew him, it was, well, at Chikusa High School where I go, because Chikusa was the top-ranked school in the area. And they'll let you know. And in his case, he would go to school, and he would get out of cram school at, like, 6:30, and, like, I would assume run. He got to us pretty quickly, it seemed, after that, and eat dinner with us, and then have his English lesson at 7. So that guy was super busy. And he somehow had time to be in the band and play the saxophone. I don't know how he pulled that all off, but somehow I guess it came together for him.
They must be doing something in grade school that keys into the pressure cooker.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I can't just imagine kissing off.
Oh, no. They don't just mess around in grade school. That is where they start learning the discipline. But I guess I'm speaking of the parental aspect. The parents, when the kids are in grade school, they expect the school will handle the kids' discipline and that they won't have to get too involved in that, for better or worse. That's something that's kind of changed. It used to really be emphasized on parental discipline, and a lot of parents have kind of been sloughing that off on the school. Well, you're the one who should be keeping my kid in line, you know, and all this. And so that is something that's kind of shifting, but it'll be a long time before the Japanese devalue education. One of the things about The Last Samurai, actually, and I will get your new question in a minute, but you just reminded me because I saw you. One of the things about The Last Samurai that was very accurate was the samurai practicing painting their letters exactly right. There's a certain way to make kanji. There's a certain order you go in for each stroke, and if you go out of order, they will tell you that you've gone out of order, and it's wrong. Even if it looks exactly the same, you've gone out of order, so it's wrong. Very strict about that. The last samurai did, I think, show kind of the emphasis that the samurai placed on education, which is part of why that trickled down to the rest of the country. There were not, compared to, like, feudal Europe, there were hardly any illiterate samurai. Almost all of them knew their letters. They also studied art and flower arranging and things we don't necessarily associate with fearless warriors, but they certainly did. Making it look pretty because there was aesthetic value in it. So,
You know, at post-World War II, and being that we were the ones who dropped the bombs on, is there still a lot of resentment? Like, and how does that affect you as an American?
Well, I didn't have anyone... I did have a student I remember who brought up, I would ask the students, so what did you do this weekend, as kind of a conversation starter for my advanced class. And one of the students, one time, it was a little awkward, they were like, oh, I went to the Hiroshima Museum. And I was like, oh. Something was like, oh, man. And it was, there was like an awkward pause for all of us. We were just like, ooh, right, he's American. but then, you know, I mean, just I just asked, you know, what was it like, what was in there, and it was a good conversation. But I don't think, yeah, like I said, I never had anybody, like, blame me for it, certainly. I think that it's one of the things that I think made the gospel spreading in Japan right after World War II difficult, was that even though the Christians did win the war and they dropped this, they still committed this atrocity, and they're telling us we did all this terrible stuff in the camps, but they dropped this on civilians, and I mean, you know, killed 80,000 people in a second, basically, and that was definitely one of the things that was on their mind as people were preaching a gospel of peace, was, really? doesn't seem to be what happened, for better or worse. They are, I will say this, I did notice it affected their view of nuclear energy. And in fact, that's one of the things the leadership has been trying to build more nuclear plants throughout the country, because they are desperately in need of more power in the next few years. And there's been a lot of resistance to it, partly because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but even more so because of what happened at Fukushima with the reactor going crazy. And, no one wants to be the next Chernobyl, obviously. So, yeah.
To think that disdain is reserved for the military.
Yes. Being in a military uniform in Japan, obviously an American military uniform, will not make you any friends any more than I think if somebody were walking around in our streets wearing, I don't even know any of what the other uniforms look like.
Yeah.
How imperialist am I? right, yeah, I don't know, a red coat maybe, I don't know. Whatever the other armies wear, you know, if they were walking around wearing that, we probably wouldn't go out of our way to be like, oh, hi, who are you? You know, like, we'd be like, that guy's weird, he's wearing, you know, whatever it is. Yeah, they're definitely not fond of having they're not fond of having the American military nearby. They are pretty fond of having a fairly good economy. Even though they've been in recession for 15 years, they've still had a pretty good economy, partly because they don't have to fund a military themselves. They have the self-defense forces, which is like maybe 60 people, I seem to think. that's an underestimation, but it's still fairly, it may as well be, really. I mean, if China or someone else is invaded, there's no way they'd really be able to defend themselves. And there was actually, while I was there, somebody went to jail because they posted a fake Yahoo News story. They made a fake website that looked just like Yahoo News. And remember, this was 2005, so it was back when the internet was still primitive and backward. So it looked just like a Yahoo News page. If you looked at the address, you'd see it was not news.yahoo.com, but it looked exactly like one, and it was claiming that the Chinese Red Army had invaded Okinawa, which China does claim some ownership over Okinawa. It's kind of a thorny issue. I don't really understand all of it, but it was claiming that happened, and a bunch of people freaked out and started panicking, and I think it actually affected like their stock prices for a day or something until people finally realized it wasn't true, and it was sort of a big, and yeah, that person did go to jail because that's like, you know, dangerous to do that. So yeah, so it's, their relationship with our military is complicated, to say the least. They're happy having the defense, they're not happy having us actually be there, you know, with guns and in force, which I guess is understandable.
I think we're probably about it.
Probably a time, yeah.
And maybe Bill, maybe you could pray.
Father, we thank you for our time here together, listening to preparations and insights, and just thinking about ministry in a country which in some ways is very different from the one that we're in. But Lord, these are people with spiritual needs, and we just pray that you would oversee the preparation of these two missionaries and their work as they travel to this country. Christ, I pray.
Amen.
Thank you.
So, during the service at the beginning, I'll have a
question.